All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. This is going to be the last lesson, so we're going to try and wrap up everything as far as American church history goes today. And last week we looked at the Enlightenment and the effects that the Enlightenment had on Christianity in general, the kind of problems that it posed. And then looking at the state of the church and what was going on there, and then how kind of three things that were all interconnected, German Pietism, Methodism, and the Great Awakening, how all of those sought to kind of deal with the problems posed by the Enlightenment. The Great Awakening dies away in the late 1740s in the Northeast. Now, we'll see today that that doesn't necessarily happen everywhere, and especially in places like Virginia and North Carolina, in the back country areas where people like the Baptists and the Methodists are going to be prominent. That's not necessarily going to be the case. The revivals will continue, and those two denominations in particular will continue to grow, especially the Baptist in Virginia, not so much the Methodist as they're associated with the Church of England. And so during the American Revolution, that's not going to be beneficial for them. And Wesley will come out pretty violently against the revolution in America. But after the First Great Awakening ends, there's going to be a number of things at which the church, once again, especially in America and uniquely in America, and we're going to be talking about really just focusing on America today, is going to have to deal with. So the condition of the church after the First Great Awakening is going to be important. And it's going to be in these years, if we can go to the first slide, it's going to be in these years, in the time after the founding of the country, that events are going to transpire and things are going to happen that is really going to bring about the identity that we typically think of as American Christianity. So the identity of America as a Christian nation, in which the majority of the people inside the nation are Christian and hold to what would be considered, at least in large part, traditionally Christian beliefs. This is going to be the time period where all of that comes about and where Christianity becomes a real vital and powerful force inside America as a whole. Not just in certain areas of the country, which had been the case before the Second Great Awakening, but it's really the Second Great Awakening that's going to create really what we might think of as a Christian American culture. But in the years between the First and Second Great Awakening, if we want to think about that, the First Great Awakening ends in 1740. We typically talk about the Second Great Awakening beginning either in the late 1780s, 1790s, even maybe sometimes as late as the very beginning of the 1800s. So we have about a 60, however you want to think about it, a 40 to 60 year window that we're talking about. And in this period, we're going to have a weakened church, and we're going to talk about the reasons for that. But the church in the United States is going to go through a period of decline. Part of the reason for that is going to be the American Revolution and the ensuing rationalism that is a part of that. The ideas that the revolution brings about, and then the French Revolution, which is taking place during this time as well, the events leading up to it. And then what we're really going to get, before we really get to the beginning of the Second Great Awakening, and even when we get to the beginning of the Second Great Awakening, it's kind of a synthesis, a joining together, combining of Christianity and rationalism in a very unique and interesting way that's going to set apart American Christianity. And a lot of denominations are going to be particularly involved in this. So part of the area in which the church is weakened, if we want to go to the first one, is after the First Great Awakening, what you're going to end up with in the North in particular for a number of years is going to be a divided church. The Congregationalist Church, the Presbyterian Church, not the Anglicans. The Anglicans aren't really affected by this, and they're not really in the area that we're talking about anyway, in the Northeast and the Middle Atlantic states. The Presbyterian and Congregationalist churches are the major denominations in America. And both of these denominations are going to be split by the First Great Awakening. Congregationalists will be split into Old Light and New Light. Congregationalists will be split into Old Light and New Light. Presbyterians will be split into Old Side and New Side. And these divisions that the First Great Awakening is going to cause aren't going to be fully mended until the eve of the American Revolution. There's a very interesting book, it's just about the American Revolution in general, that talks about just Lexington and Concord and just kind of looks at those towns on the eve of the Revolution and tries to look at the Revolution through those towns. Well, their congregations were split, and they weren't healed actually until after the revolution had begun. So you have bitter church battles. And you have to remember, at the time, the church was funded by the state. So when you pay taxes in Massachusetts or anywhere, any of the colonies, except maybe Pennsylvania and Rhode Island and some of the colonies like that, your taxes are going to supporting a minister, one. And that was your choice. And that's what you had. And it was a Congregationalist minister or a Presbyterian or an Anglican minister. And these congregations, to split and to form a new church was a big deal, because that meant that you were still paying taxes that supported the other guy. And then you had to continually fund out of your own pocket even more this other person. So that's a big emphasis on what's happening and why the church is being weakened. Also, one of the hallmarks of the First Great Awakening was that it produced a number of strong leaders inside American churches. And not just American churches, but in England as well. So we had people like the Wesley brothers. We had people like Whitfield, Jonathan Edwards, of course, and other people, Gilbert Tennent, and a number of other people that we didn't get a chance necessarily to talk about last time. But there are a number of strong leaders. Those leaders are not going to be, our leaders of that caliber are not going to be around in the years between the First and Second Great Awakening. By the time we get to the Second Great Awakening, there'll be a new crop of people that are going to be very, very influential and are going to lead the church on. And finally, what we have in America is the growth of a very large non-Christian population. And by that, I don't necessarily mean that they didn't hold maybe Christian beliefs, or they didn't maybe think of themselves as being influenced by Christianity, but they weren't what we consider typical Christians. They didn't go to church. That could be because there just wasn't a church where they were. And there are a lot of reasons for this. Settlement of the West, and when we say the West, we don't mean beyond the Mississippi. We might even mean like Western Connecticut might have been the West, or definitely Western New York or Central New York was the far West. Like someone that moved there, you might not see them ever again. Especially if they moved across the mountains, which the far western part of New York State would. Let's say you moved to Ohio or Tennessee or Kentucky. You would probably never see that person again if that was your family member, because 6, 7, 8 months to travel back, maybe, across the wild in the wilderness with everything else that was going on. I mean, and you go out there, not like people came to the United States in a ship with 60, 40 other people that were all together that you came with. You went in ones and twos, maybe in wagon trains of some, but you had to settle. You didn't settle in towns. You settled on farms. So you were scattered out. So you have a lot of people that are just kind of by themselves, isolated, and they don't have churches and things like that. So you have that kind of population that's developing in the West. That's going to be a problem as the church has to deal with this very large, rough, semi-unchristian population. You also have immigrant populations that for the first time in large numbers after the American Revolution are beginning to arrive in the United States. So you have Irish Catholics and different things like this will be prevalent among these. And then you have, corresponding to both of these, you have growing cities. And this is also going to produce large numbers of urban population that aren't necessarily going to be reached in traditional kind of Christian ways. So you have these, as these cities grow and as urbanization takes place, that's going to continue to take place over the rest of the American history. Also, at the same time, what we're going to have is the American Revolution is going to take place. So obviously, the First Great Awakening had been this great focus on religion and revival. But by the time that ends, by the 1740s and 50s, people are beginning to be focused not on religion and revivalism, but on the problem with England. And so obviously that's directing their focus away from religion. The majority of the writing and the people that are going to be influential during the American Revolution, while they might hold to traditional Christian beliefs about morality and different things like this, they're not going to be what we would consider traditionally Christian people in their beliefs on the nature of God and the nature of man and different things like that. They're going to have divergent views. This is a picture of Washington. It used to stand in the United States Capitol, and him being portrayed as Zeus. This is modeled off the statue of Zeus. So they just took a statue of Zeus from classical antiquity pretty much and just stuck Washington's head on it. This is part of one of the things that happens, is this creation of a state, almost religion or deification takes place of a number of early American political figures. And for the deist and for other people at this time, their emphasis on religion was the creation of good morals, which of course is important. We want to say that, but they were concerned with it because they believed that morals and right living and different things like that, virtue, were essential to good government, which it probably is. So that's what Alex de Tocqueville in the 1830s, a Frenchman, is going to come to America, and his statement is going to be, America is good because, is great because its people are good and moral, and they're going to be, that's going to be influenced. Tocqueville is going to come after the Second Great Awakening has been going on for 30 or 40 years. Also, we have the growing influence of rationalism that comes out of the American Revolution. This is going to take place in anti-clericism, so reactions against priests and pastors and clerics and different things like this. Every man is his own pastor. That's going to be a big influence in the Second Great Awakening. The majority of the figures that we're going to talk about are going to shun formal pastoral training. And they're going to be, in a lot of ways, almost blatantly anti-intellectual, in a sense that they don't want to be taught. They want to, it's an experience, right? I have a, or a call or different things like that, which isn't necessarily wrong, but they are going to be anti-clerical in a large sense and anti-intellectual, which is kind of a new thing that comes up. Also, one of the big things that's going to come out of the American Revolution is that idea that the government supports churches is going to be done away with. So that's going to be done away with, obviously, in the Bill of Rights, but each individual colony will also do away with it. So Virginia does away with it in the late 1780s, and then later it goes along. The last colony to do away with it is Massachusetts, and that's not until the, I think, the second decade of the 1800s when that happens. So church, or state support of churches is done away with, and that's going to create a revolution inside how churches are run and how they function. So if churches have been getting money from the government to pay for ministers and to pay for the building and all this other stuff, if that's done away with, the church is going to have to reorient how it gets members, how it raises money, how it supports its pastors, all that kind of stuff. And then another thing that comes out of the revolution is the growth in Unitarianism, which is this idea of, we won't have a lot of time to talk about it, but one of the things that happens, especially in congregational churches, this is a unique thing to congregational churches, is after that split that takes place during the First Great Awakening, you have a lot of the people who move in a more rationalistic way, away from the experience of the First Great Awakening, move into Unitarianism, which is this belief in, or non-belief, I should say, in the Trinity or the oneness of God, unity, Unitarianism. People like John Adams are going to become Unitarians. Thomas Jefferson, while he doesn't claim any religion, in a lot of his writings makes claims that if I was going to have a religion, I would believe in the unity of God, this kind of Unitarianism. He's big on that. So those are the things that are going on with the church at the time. And what's going to develop out of this is a kind of synthesis between the ideas of rationalism and the revolution. So the democratization and privatization of religion is going to take place in a large part out of this. And what I mean by that is that people are really free to choose, in a way that they really haven't had that freedom before in America, what they're going to believe. They're not going to be bound by any sort of governmental structure that's telling them what to believe, no sort of state-sponsored church. And they're also, because of the revolution, this idea of freedom, like I am free to do something, I'm free not just from political tyranny, but a big part of political tyranny, if you can go all the way back to when we were talking about the Stuarts, you remember that James the first statement was, no bishop, no king. So, in a sense, many governments viewed church structure as an extension of political structure. And church power and ecclesiastical power as an extension of governmental power. And so, not only are they going to be free from the crown of England, but they're also going to be free to choose their religion in a way that they've never been free to do that before. And that's going to cause a lot of problems, but it's going to be a recipe for divergence and different ideas and people thinking new thoughts and not being bound by any sort of authority. So they're going to renounce authority, not just in regard to bishops and the Church of England and maybe standard church structures, but even what we would consider even just, wow. So that's where we're going with that. Okay, so we'll see how just the wide range of ideas that people are going to have. And they're going to adopt Enlightenment ideas. So, rational universe. A lot of what you're going to hear about from people during this time period of American religious history is the rationalism of Christianity. How rational it is. If I just present it to you in a rational way, this is what's going to happen. So, a corresponding, the universe is rational, Christianity and the message of Christianity is rational as well. It's able to be understood and grasped by the mind, and that's what's needed. So that kind of idea. The moral and civic importance of religion is going to be adopted by many people within the Second Great Awakening and even afterwards. So you're going to have people that are going to come to Christianity and they're going to say, yes, this is right. And now what religion's purpose is not just the saving of souls, it's also the improvement of morals and the improvement thereby of the civic structure and the way that people relate, not just one to another, but even how the government relates and all these other things. So we're going to get a lot of social reform that's going to come out of this. Also, a belief in progress. This movement is going to be huge. Thousands of people are going to be converted. Massive camp meetings, massive revivals inside of cities, out in the country. And so what this is going to lead people to believe in, people are going to know about this because of print and new technology, newspapers and things like this. So people are going to know that this is happening. This is going to feed this idea of progress, which they already have based on the American Revolution and everything else that's been going on. This is an Enlightenment idea. So this revival is going to feed into that. They're going to see not just the religious progress that's happening, but also the civic and moral progress that goes along with that. How people's lives are changed and how that then affects society. And they're going to believe that this progress is just part of what Christianity is about. They're going to buy into that. And they're going to preach that almost as a doctrine. That this is what's going to happen. And this is what we need to do. Right? This is, in a sense, the idea of progress becomes essential to a lot of what they're going to take. And then another big thing that's going to come out of this idea in this synthesis between the Enlightenment and rationalism and the Second Great Awakening is going to be a change in the view of the nature of mankind. So, typically before this, everyone agreed to the fallen nature of man. Even people like Wesley and Arminians, this is one of the big misconceptions I think about Arminianism, is Arminianism doesn't preach a kind of man is good kind of doctrine. It preaches a man is depraved doctrine. People like Wesley are going to be very clear about the total depravity of man. That he is depraved, that there is, you know, that he is in need of God. That is not going to be, in a lot of ways, what comes out of the Second Great Awakening. This synthesis with rationalism is going to breed this belief in, and it's not going to come from Methodists typically, or other people that we might think of Arminians. It's going to typically come from Presbyterians and Congregationalists. This idea that man is actually good in a way that he has the ability to alter his life and his destiny, and that man is actually a good thing that just needs to be reformed in some ways. And that there's nothing inherently evil about the nature of man. So those are going to be the things that kind of come out of it. And now we can actually get to the awakening themselves. Three big points about the awakening that I want to make, and then I'll talk about the map for a second. The Second Great Awakening is really the beginning of what we want to call voluntary religion, where people are freely choosing to be part of certain organizations and certain churches and making this sort of choice. This is the first great evangelical, meaning we're going out and preaching the gospel to people who would have been typically seen as unchurched. So you have a lot of people. This is the first big voluntary push. Before this, the First Great Awakening, if you remember back, is going to take place mostly among people who are already churched, people who are already members of church. It's a reawakening or a revival among people who are already Christians. The Second Great Awakening is going to do that in some ways, but it's going to move beyond that. So we have a voluntary aspect to this that's going to be very, very important. And then it's got two main phases or two main areas. And really, there's not a lot of connection between these, even though they're happening at the same time, even though they know about each other and they view each other as part of the same thing. It's not like we have someone, not even someone really like a Whitfield who would have traveled all up and down or all over the place. There are people who did take place in both, but they're not going to be incredibly important people. Like people like Peter Cartwright start in Kentucky, but then he moves to the Northwest, and he does that not because he views it as some greater, like he's continuing on. He just doesn't like slavery. And so he moves out of Kentucky and moves to Illinois because slavery doesn't exist in Illinois. So, things like that. So the two areas are going to be, one, we have Kentucky and Tennessee, and then a little bit of the Ohio River Valley here is going to be one. And the other one is going to begin in Connecticut and Massachusetts, and it's going to spread to Western New York. And then from Western New York, it's going to spread into what we would consider the old Northwest territories, Northern Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, which also at the time included Wisconsin and places like that. So these are the two big areas. And they're going to really, really be, in a lot of ways, the same. They're going to be similar characteristics, but they're really going to end up going in pretty different directions. And part of that's going to revolve around the growing sectionalism of the country and different ideas. That's going to play a part in this, but they are going to be not really the same thing. So let's move on. We're going to talk about the Southern Revival first. The revivals in the South are really going to be carryovers from the First Great Awakening. In the back country of Virginia, especially among Baptists, revivals can continue to take place. The First Great Awakening came very, very late to Virginia. End of the 1740s, maybe even in the 1750s is when it's just picking up among Baptists in Virginia. Baptists are a very, very small denomination in Virginia, but they are an anti-establishment denomination. They are not recognized. They are not allowed to be there. Only Anglicans are allowed in Virginia. It's the official religion. It's a crown-controlled colony. But nevertheless, Baptists continue to make converts in Virginia, and they especially do this outside of the Tidewater area and back the further you get into the mountains and hill country of Virginia. And what you're going to have is you're going to have a form of Baptist that's going to be theology that's going to be preached to the common people. It's going to be very frontier oriented. You guys are able to make this decision for yourself. So it is Arminian in the sense of how we view man's will to act and different things like that. Their ability to respond. It's a choice that you have to make. Those type of things, which was going to appeal to the more free people. And then it's going to spread over the mountains in the 1790s. And even before that, you can talk about it maybe spreading there. People like Daniel Boone is going to be a former Baptist. And other of the early settlers are obviously going to be people that had been religious perhaps before, but that's going to be the case with Daniel Boone. He's going to be a former Baptist. And what you're going to have is in the 1780s and 90s, you're going to have churches that are going to begin to spring up in the areas across the mountains. So these are going to begin. The First Presbyterian Church comes to Kentucky in about 1784. There are 12 more churches in the next year, so this is a rapid spread. So once the denominations start coming over the mountains, the spread of the churches is pretty rapid. The First Methodists crossed the mountain in 1791. By 1800, 9 years later, there are 2,000 Methodists in Kentucky. The Baptists are even earlier. Before 1776, there were Baptists over the mountain. And because of the way that the Baptist church is structured, right, they don't have formal ministers. There's just people that are would have been local members of the congregation that would have had a call to preach. They're a little bit harder to date. But we do know that by 1785, there are over a dozen churches in Kentucky alone in three different associations. So we do have, by the time they start banding together and forming associations, we have a good idea. But we don't need to think, I mean, by the time we get to like 17, about the time of the Constitution, when we talk about 2,000 people maybe are Methodists, you have to understand that in Kentucky there would have been about 75,000 people at the time. So this still, the number of people that are inside of churches or that are formal part of churches is a very small percentage of the population. I mean, just in Kentucky, not necessarily. Even when we start talking about it in broader senses of the population, it's even smaller. So in 1776, there might have been 5,000 Methodists, and Baptists and Methodists are going to be the denominations that we're going to focus on the majority of our time, and Presbyterians and Congregationalists a little bit too. But in the South, what we're really talking about is Methodists and Baptists. And they're going to be the denominations that grow the most out of this. 5,000 Methodists at the time of the Revolution. By the time we get to the end of the First Great Awakening, we're talking about almost 1.2 million Methodists. The same kind of thing as with Baptists in general. 35,000 Baptists maybe in 1790. By the time we get to 1748, we're looking at about 1 million Baptists. So we have this massive explosion of growth that's going to take place in this time period. And the majority of it is going to take place in the West. And when we say the West, of course, I'm still meaning we live in the West as far as these people were concerned. Way, way West. I mean, at this point, where we are isn't even settled yet. We're still talking about just barely over the mountains is like the middle of nowhere. We might as well live on the moon, let alone somewhere else like crazy, like way out in West Tennessee. All right. So if we move on to the next slide, we can see that the way that this is going to spread, the way that the revival in the South is going to spread is through camp meetings. The nature of the West at the time, people living on scattered individual farms, out away from everyone else, the only way that you could get enough people together is with these camp meetings. So in the summer, when the crops are growing and there's not a lot of work to do, if you're a farmer, in the spring and harvest, you have a lot to do, but in the summer, you can take a little time off if you need to. So in the summer, before harvest time, what you'd have is you'd have a number of these camp meetings that would take place all across the South. Now, they begin in 1800 in Kentucky. A guy by the name of McGreedy is the guy who starts the first one. He holds a camp meeting, and it's what we're going to think of. He's the guy who sets the pattern. It's outdoors because there's not a building that's going to be big enough to contain all these people. There is a church. It's going to be a log church. You'll see a picture of the inside of one in just a second. It's not very big. And it's going to, because the people have to travel from such a long distance away, you know, hundreds of miles sometimes, even if you travel 20 miles. I mean, that's an all-day trip through the wilderness. That's like driving to, you know, that might be like driving to Chicago now for someone else. For us today, that kind of distance might be 20 or 30 miles, let alone if you have to travel. People would travel for weeks sometimes to get to these meetings. So very long, and that's going to lead to this long duration for the camp meeting. It's not just going to be a day. It's not just going to be a couple days. It's going to be a week, typically, is the typical structure of it. And it's going to be attended not just by one denomination, but it's going to be by everyone. So different ministers from different denominations are going to come and preach at these things. And the first one is going to take place in 1800. We should not think of the people who would have necessarily attended these meetings as being dressed necessarily like this. This is a later drawing or painting of it. So these people are all dressed up very nicely. The people who would have come to these would have not been nice sorts of people. These would have been the people that said, yes, it is a good deal, a good idea that I leave wherever I am right now and I just go with a wagon and a gun and some seed and maybe an implement and an animal too, and I just go live off in the wilderness, you know, with the Indians and the bears and everything else, and I'm going to form a life out there and I don't have to be around other people. People, who needs those guys? That's the kind of people who are, these people are not going to be your typically, you know, well-educated kind of thing. I mean, and it's going to lead to a lot of kind of people wondering what's actually going on at these revivals. There's a funny quote that said that there are more people born out of camp meetings than born again out of camp meetings. So that's kind of one of the things, some of the things, because these people are not, you know, your typical morally upstanding type of people that are going to come. These are the people that are on the fringes of society that said, law, order, no, I don't need that. I can be my own law and order if I go out west. So that's kind of the thing. Now, this is going to end up leading to really the, you want to think about it, you can go to the next slide now. What we're going to talk about, Cane Ridge, and this is really, the Americans actually viewed it this way. This was the American Pentecost. In a lot of ways. They even said that this is the greatest outpouring of the Spirit since Pentecost. A guy that was at the first meeting, a guy by the name of Barton Stone, is a Presbyterian minister near Cane Ridge in Kentucky. This is the inside of the Cane Ridge Meeting House. Not very big. And he publicizes the event that's coming up very well. It draws an enormous crowd, 10 to 25,000 people, not just 10,000 to 25,000 people. And what we have is this outpouring. Thousands of people are supposedly saved and converted. And Stone himself writes down a list of all the emotionalism that's going to take place. So here it is. Falling, jerks, dancing, barking, grunting, laughing, running, and singing that all take place among people at this time. It's very, very emotional. And that's also going to lead, especially among the Presbyterians who are kind of shocked at what's going on at these camp meetings, as kind of saying, no, we don't want anything to do with this. And that's going to lead Barton Stone and McGreedy to leave the Presbyterian Church. And a number of people in the Presbyterian Church eventually, especially in the South, are going to form the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. It's going to be formed out of the Second Great Awakening. But so this is what happens, and this is going to spread revival all across the South. These camp meetings are going to spring up everywhere, and they're going to last for decades. And we should really understand, it's hard for us when we live in the society and the time period that we do to understand the power that this meeting would have on people who don't see anyone else for the majority of the year. And then 1 week you come and you're around all these people, thousands of people. You know, they're in religious services 3-4 times a day. In between, there's prayers and people getting converted all around them. I mean, they're being preached to in torchlight at night and all these other things like this. It would be a very charged kind of atmosphere that they'd be in. This kind of emotionalism is to be expected. But there are a number of consequences that come out of this. It's going to set the pattern for the rest of American evangelicalism. I mean, if you think about, the modern, evangelistic crusade, in a lot of ways, is no more than just a modern big camp meeting. Thousands of people getting together and the same type of thing happens. This sets the pattern. This is what we tend to expect is what this looks like rest of the time. It's the beginning of a revival. This is going to transform the denominational landscape of the country. So the reason why Baptists and Methodists are the major denomination in the United States today, or at least Methodists used to be anyway, is because of this. This is the reason. This is where it all starts. And it's going to lead to a lot of criticism and rejection and division. So people are going to criticize each other for their theology that's going to develop out of this. Barton Stone ends up becoming an anti-Trinitarian. A number of the other people who are along with him are going to become Shakers and a number of other things. So, I mean, you're going to get a lot of just weird theological things. You're going to get a lot of rejection of other people's ideas and other people's denominations and eventually divisions inside denominations, especially the established denominations. You're not going to see Baptists and Methodists necessarily divide until you get to the Civil War. But the Presbyterians are going to be divided 4 times over the Second Great Awakening. Once in the North and once in the South. So you have 4 Presbyterian denominations where you had 1 before. So all that's going to happen. Now in the North, or the East, if you want to think about it that way, what you're going to have is a scattering of revivals that are going to begin in the Connecticut River Valley. So the Connecticut River Valley runs, its mouth is in Connecticut, but it runs all the way up. So all the way through Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, you're going to have a scattering of revivals that break out. And these are very, very similar to the First Great Awakening. Very, very different from what's happening at the same time period in the South. They're going to be led by established ministers, educated ministers, especially ministers that have studied at Yale and Princeton are going to be the two big areas. Those congregations that have moved away from the First Great Awakening and more towards a Unitarian belief, they are not going to be affected by this awakening. And the people who are affected by that view that as a judgment, right? You guys have moved outside of Christianity, and so this revival that's happening obviously isn't affecting you, since you are now outside of what it means to be a Christian. And it's going to take place in established churches. It's not going to be this meeting that takes place and draws people who aren't who are not Christians in. And it's non-emotional. Non-emotional. So it's not going to be charged with emotion the same way that things are in the East. Now, one of the odd things that the Second Great Awakening is going to do in the East is it's going to create associations and societies that are not tied to a particular church. So these are going to be big societies. As this revival grows and as people realize that there are multiple churches experiencing this, they begin banding the people in them together towards certain tasks. And these are going to especially form out of the colleges that have sprung up during the First Great Awakening. So at Andover, you're going to have Andover Seminary, which is founded when Harvard becomes Unitarian. The people in Harvard who are still traditional Reformed Congregationalists leave and found their own seminary at Andover in Massachusetts. At Andover, you're going to have people like Adoniram Judson here, who is going to go. Now, he's a Congregationalist when he leaves to go to India. By the time he gets to India, he's a Baptist. And this is going to lead to the founding of missionary societies, Bible societies, tract societies, Sunday school societies. All these societies are going to be founded in which to further the work of the Second Great Awakening. Some of the things that's noticed is, right, they knew that people had left the East and gone West, and they knew that they didn't have churches, so we need to go out and send missionaries, not just to India and other places like that, but out West too. We need, one of the first things that they did when the United States purchased the Louisiana Territory was they sent some Congregationalists down to New Orleans, and they said, we couldn't find one Bible to buy or have or anything, not one, in any language. So we're going to need to print Bibles and make sure that Bibles are available, tracts are available, so that we can spread the news about Jesus and different things like that in Sunday schools. Now, Sunday schools are not what we typically think of Sunday schools as being now, so where people would come before church like now and hear lessons. They were actual schools in which they taught reading and writing to people who did not know how to read and write. So that's what the Sunday schools did. These were ways of trying to educate people in the West. And the Sunday school societies didn't form Sunday schools. They just mainly were publishing and writing facilities that made this these types of materials available. So eventually, though, the Second Great Awakening is going to lead within the Congregationalist church to a number of shifts. These are going to be doctrinal shifts, practical shifts, and focal shifts. So doctrinally, they're going to reject man's depravity, and they're going to embrace a rational form of Christianity, that Christianity is a rational thing that can be understood, non-emotional, at least at first. Also, practical shifts. Presbyterians and Congregationalists are going to come to form a union in 1801, and this is especially going to be important because of their focal shift, because this union is going to take place in the western part of the country, where there aren't enough maybe Presbyterians or Congregationalists in and of themselves to form a church, but if they got together, they could form a church, and that's going to allow that to happen. So some of their church polity differences are going to be done away with. And another practical shift is they're going to start embracing emotional revivalism in the Western areas, and that's going to lead to the focal shift is their focus is no longer going to be on the East and in established churches, but it's rather going to be turned westward, especially to Western New York. And it's going to be primarily aimed at reaching those people that are not in church. So I'm going to look at this shifts through two people that I think you might find interesting. The first is a guy by the name of Lyman Beecher. Beecher was converted by Timothy Dwight at Yale. He goes on and starts revivals in a number of his churches. And his church, when he's a pastor in Boston, he's going to fight against Unitarianism. He's also going to be an active social reformer. He's going to be the co-founder of the American Temperance Union. So leading the charge against just intemperance in general. And eventually, Timothy Dwight's who's going to be the guy who really focuses the temperance society on just alcohol and complete abstinence, not just temperance. But he's also going to be a social reformer in another way. He's going to be very, very anti-slavery and one of the early abolitionists. And he's also going to be involved in this shift in focus, and that eventually he's going to move west to Cincinnati, Ohio, where he's going to become the president of Lane Theological Seminary, which has opened up there. And so he's going to have a number of children that are going to be famous. His probably his most famous child that you'll know is going to be Harriet Beecher Stowe, who writes Uncle Tom's Cabin. So that's her father. So the next guy is going to be another one who comes after him. It's going to be Charles Finney. Charles Finney, unlike Beecher, who was born in the East and then moved West, He's going to actually going to be raised in Western New York. He's going to be a lawyer. And his famous saying is that he's been put on retainer by the Lord to plead his case. That's how he explains his conversion experience, right? I was a lawyer, but now I'm God's lawyer arguing his case for him. That's going to be his style, too. It's going to be this very kind of rational, just explain it to you and give it to you just like it is. And then you make a decision, just like a jury would. That type of idea. And he's going to refuse any sort of formal theological training. That's going to be offered to him in his conversion. You know, why don't you go back east and get some schooling? No, I don't need it. That type of thing. And he's going to embrace in the East the camp revival style. And he's going to do this in his revivals in Western New York. And then he's going to bring that back to the East Coast in his revivals to in New York and a different thing. I'll tell you a funny story about Finney. This is probably my favorite story about him. Is that one day Finney's going along. He's coming, going to a meeting that he's going to have at this place. And he sees a little boy by the side of the road. A little boy has a trumpet with him. He says, son, what's your name? He says, Gabriel. He says, Gabriel, I got a job for you. Why don't you come with me? So he puts him up, puts him on the horse, takes him there. He says, Gabriel, I want you to go sit in the top of that pine tree up there, and I want you to do exactly what I tell you to do as soon as I tell you to do it. And Gabriel's like, yes, sir. Climbs up in the tree, sits there. Later that afternoon, when Finney is preaching to everyone, he's giving it to them, telling them what's going to happen. He said, and, you know, God is going to come back, and Gabriel is going to blow that trumpet. Gabriel, blow your trumpet. And the boy up in the tree blows his trumpet and everyone falls out, thinking that it's really the end. But that's Finney's style. And this is the big thing, is that he is controversial. That's a controversial method, but he's controversial in his understanding. And this is what he says, that revival is not a divine miracle. It's not. It is the use of rational, scientific means to achieve a, if you do this, this will happen. Cause and effect relationship. There is a cause and effect relationship. It is rational. This is how rationalism. He's also controversial in his theological stances, believing in the possibility of holiness and in, let's see, what is the other one? In the rationality of revivals, that's right. So he believes in the holiness. Like, I am able to not sin because sin is a conscious choice on my part. That's what sin is. And since sin is a conscious choice and I'm able to consciously choose not to sin, I can be without sin. So those types of ideas. And he also eventually becomes an educator. He goes on and he's the second president of Oberlin College in Ohio. And Oberlin's going to be a college where this revivalism mentality is going to be spread in the people that it educates, and eventually it's going to become one of the founding places of the abolitionist movement. So differences between the first and second Great Awakening, this might be a good time to kind of look at them. So we have Calvinistic and Arminian. Now it is Arminian, but there's also more to it than just that, right? This different view of human nature and what man is. So, and then there's the rest of them. Reawakening, mass conversions, intellectual, anti-intellectual. First Great Awakening is pretty unorganized. The Second Great Awakening, through all these societies and everything else that are going to form, is going to be fairly organized. Not a lot of social impact in the First Great Awakening, but a lot of social changes are going to come out of the Second Great Awakening. And the First Great Awakening is really not going to produce a lot of heretical beliefs, and the Second Great Awakening is going to have a bunch. And let's turn to some of those consequences of the Second Great Awakening. And we'll look at each of these in detail as we have time. We might not have time to get to all of them. So unifying its divisive heresies, education, society, social reform, and the union of the church and the republic are the ones I want to focus on if I have, with whatever time I have left. Unity and division is going to be, I'm just going to go over this very quickly. It's not, the unity is going to happen in the fact that you have places like the Presbyterian Church and the Congregational Church that are getting together over the First Great Awakening. You're also going to have people like Thomas Campbell, who's preaching a very simple form of a gospel that he thinks is so simple that anyone of any denomination can fall under its umbrella. This is kind of what is meant by the beginning of the Restorationist movement, which his son, Alexander Campbell, is going to further. And it's not going to be bringing unity at all. It's going to actually be really divisive. And Presbyterians, we have Northern split between the old and new school, and this is going to be a theological split that's going to take place and a practical split. They're not going to be comfortable with the union with the Congregationalists. And the Southern split is going to be theological as well, where the Cumberland Presbyterians split off over theological differences with the main Presbyterian church. And then you have the Restorationists who are going to come around, and these are going to reject traditional denominations, and what they're going to do is going to found their own traditional denomination out of this rejection. And they're going to be very, very prevalent. The Restorationists are going to be very powerful in the 1830s and 40s. They kind of come to the Second Great Awakening late and kind of jump on the bandwagon, but they pull. I mean, at one point, I think parts of Kentucky are down to two Presbyterian churches because of all the Restorationists. I think First Baptist Nashville has just 7 or 8 members at one point because the Stone and Campbell people have pulled them all away. Now, eventually, that's going to be undone, and a lot of them are going to come back, but that's kind of what's going on. Next up, we have the crazies that are going to come out. And there are a lot of these, and this is going to really take place. Every one of these groups form out of one district in western New York. It's called the Burned Over District. It's this area on the Erie Canal, which was built at this time period between really Albany and Buffalo, New York. And revival is going to spread back and forth across this area over and over again over a number of years. And every one of these divergent sects are going to come out of this. So the Millerites, who's founded by a guy named Miller, and they're going to believe in the imminent second coming of Christ. It's going to take place in 1843. He's going to come back, and he doesn't, obviously, since we're still here. And this is going to lead to the great disappointment. Out of that, though, is going to come a number of, you know, semi, maybe heterodox denominations. People like the Seventh-day Adventists are going to come out of this, and they're going to come out of Miller's disappointment. You have people like the Shakers, although they don't come and start during the Second Great Awakening. They're already here. They do gain a number of adherents during the Second Great Awakening, especially in the West. So you have, if you drive north of Nashville, there's a Shaker community right off the interstate that you can go and visit in southern Kentucky. And there's other ones up there. And also in the main Shaker places in New York, though. And they are very odd people. They believe that their founder, Mother Ann Lee, was the female incarnation of Christ. And just really, really interesting beliefs. The Oneida people in upstate New York, once again, very, very weird. Eugenics, selective breeding of people, different things like this. They are odd people. The Fox sisters and the birth of modern American spirituality, ghosts and spirits and seances and things like that. That is a big deal during this time. Just to give you an idea, there are 8 seances held in the White House during Abraham Lincoln's administration. What would we do now if the President of the United States had a seance in the White House? But Abraham Lincoln had 8 of them, at least a couple of which he participated in. Mostly they were his wife. But the Fox sisters, who are the ones who start this, come during this burned over. And most importantly, Joseph Smith. Here he is with the angel Moroni digging up his treasure in New York. He's going to come out of this burned over district. So all of these really, really odd, heretical and semi-Christian, cults or whatever you want to call them, come out of this time period and come out of these areas where revival just continually comes back again and again, and just continually like coming to areas where it's just like, that's why they call it the burn over. There's nothing left to burn there, and yet the revival is continually just burning. And what it's going to do is going to create all of these kind of crazy beliefs. Education. We have institutions of higher learning, Sunday schools that are founded. We have societies. We've talked about that. I do want to get to the next one, though, because I only have just a minute left. Social reform. This is amazing that this comes out of the Second Great Awakening, really. This is so odd, I think, in a lot of ways. But the amount of emphasis that's put on moral reform in the Second Great Awakening, how people are supposed to be transformed by becoming Christians, and how they should, how that should lead to changes in their lives. This fear of antinomianism is taking place. This leads to a great amount of just concern, and then just concern for the righteousness of society, right? We need to do this abolition, temperance. You have protection of the Sabbath, lotteries, which had been used to fund Harvard and Yale, now are are gone. Physically handicapped and mentally handicapped reforms and women's right movements all come out of the Second Great Awakening. Every one of these is born by the Second Great Awakening. And what's really odd is that, and that goes to the not the next one, but the one after that. So if we move on. Oh, no, never mind. I didn't make a slide for this one. Is this idea that to accomplish these social reforms, the thing that the Protestants are willing to do is use the government to do that. So instead of just letting the revival take its place on its own and deal with people the way that it will, what they do is they enlist the help of the government to make sure that those social reforms that they want to see happen are enforced. And they enforce them on people. And this is really a tie between the church and the state. The church has voluntarily tied itself back to the state in a way that is not going to be there's going to be comfortable for a lot of people, but it's going to end up leading to things like the Civil War. It's going to come out of this kind of tie. We're going to enforce our moral views on the rest of the country, and it's going to turn the Second Civil War into a kind of almost religious crusade. If you listen to Julia Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic, you know, let us, he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. This is this kind of idea that we have, that our job as Christians is this kind of moral reform that we're that we're doing here with the abolition of slavery, which abolition is a good thing, but it's just this tie-in that we're going to use the government to enforce our religious beliefs, whatever they may be, on other people. And that's going to happen with temperance and anti-alcohol laws that take place first in Maine in 1846. And then across the country eventually when we get to prohibition. And I think that's all the time that I have, so I'm sorry. But thank you guys. It's been a great class. I've enjoyed teaching you. I hope you've enjoyed it. Appreciate it. You're dismissed.